This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. I am leaving just a little bit early, about half hour early from what I intended, because my wife reports that we are out of internet at the house. And we have been since, I don't know, about 11 o'clock this morning, and I checked with one of my coworkers who also gets internet basically off the same feed that I do, and he said his daughter hadn't reported that she was out of internet, which that's her normal practice. And then I called my daughter, and my daughter reported that she was out of internet. So it's something with our feeds out at the house, and my daughter works from home on Friday, so I'm taking off a little early, and I actually need to swing by Staples to pick up one piece of equipment that I might possibly need, but it would be good to have as a, just as a backup piece of equipment that I could swap in if my switch goes out. So I'm going to go pick up an extra switch. Hopefully they have them there at Staples. And then I've got to head home and figure out what's going on with that. It is episode 200 today. 200 in this great pile of words. And I thought after last week, after talking about Farforth Fables and what it's going to be about, it's a little chilly today, so I'm going to turn on the heater. I thought, you know, it might be interesting just to talk about where I am at this juncture in my life. It's really interesting that I'm writing a book now about uncertainty. But that's a little apropos for me right now, this idea of uncertainty. And in fact, it's a bit apropos today to talk about this idea of uncertainty because, you know, I'm out of internet at the house. I really would like to be able to supply my daughter with internet so that she can do her job tomorrow. And yet, at this point, I have really no way to determine what the problem is. So, you know, I have been doing things and earning my way at work, but I did opt to go ahead and leave a little early. I am going to go by and pick up some potential equipment that I might need, but while I can, waiting to see if I can turn, not quite yet. While I can guess as to what might be the problem, and I certainly have four or five different possibilities, and I will go and work through them one by one, nonetheless, it's impossible for me to know what is the problem at this point. So knowing that I cannot know what the problem is, knowing that I will only be certain of that hopefully later so I can get it fixed, there is this tension that we live in our lives of the uncertain future. And some of it can be alleviated by planning a little bit. But as I told my wife today when she asked me, yeah, I wonder why it went out. I said, well, sweetie, I said, technology works until it doesn't. And that's pretty much the way anything is in the future. You know, we may think that we've got great plans and we know how things are going to go and we know what tomorrow will hold, but we really don't. Things can change very, very rapidly. And the second book in Far Forth Fables is really going to be about that. It's going to be about how everything that you thought you had can change very rapidly. And you really can't do anything about that ahead of time, because most of the time it comes as a surprise and you didn't even realize that you should be preparing for that. In terms of uncertainty, though, my life is in a very interesting place right now. And it would help if I just went back and did a little history, in case there might be someone who's listening of my two or three people who listen to this podcast. Might be someone who doesn't know my history, and I'm going to have to hop into Staples here pretty quick, but we'll get started. I went to a Bible college for my post-secondary education. I studied music, have a degree in piano. Well, I have a double major. One is in performance in piano. I did the recitals and all that sort of thing, and the other is in what's called sacred music, which is really a composition and arranging degree. And my schooling was successful. I did well in my classes. I was respected on campus, yada, yada, yada. Coming out of that, I really didn't know exactly where I was going to land. I knew I wasn't supposed to be doing music ministry in a church. I just didn't really feel like that was the right thing for me. Okay, I'm going to put this on pause. Hopefully I will not be gone so long that it shuts off. I will be back shortly. Okay, I'm back. So anyways, my life thus far, here we go. So I come out of college with a double major in performance and piano and sacred music. I am a freshly minted college graduate in 1981. And that would have been the year, I was born in 58, so that would have been the year I turned 23. I'm married. I end up with a job as a music editor. I'm dealing with a lot of paper, writing out music by hand, because that was pretty much the state of the art for music editors in 1981. Those are getting converted into music folios by our music typesetter, who is using a manual typewriter that has music typefaces on it, because that was state of the art in 1981. And I get tired of this whole paper dance, and I just decide out of the blue, I'm going to buy myself a computer, and I'm going to buy a music notation program, and ta-da, that's going to be it. And I look around, and there's nothing out there that suits my needs. And so I go ahead, and I decide I'm going to write a computer program. I have never done this before, but I just lay into it and lo and behold, managed to get this computer program written to do music notation. One thing leads to another. We end up selling that to one company. We subsequently join forces with another company, put out another product called Finale. Finale is and remains one of the two top music notation programs in the world. The other one is Sibelius. It didn't come along until long after I had left the company. Well, maybe it was around, well, no, I don't think it was. I can't remember. Anyway, so basically you have this kid who was in Springfield, Missouri, never programmed before, taught himself how to program, got hooked up with a company, was able to go on his own. In November of 1983, the year I turned 25, was able to support myself from that for the next 10 years. And frankly, if I had stayed with that, doing that, I probably would be financially independent today. But maybe because that came so easy, I decided, well, it's time to do something else. Okay, maybe because I got out of college and I was able to just make money and it didn't seem really like that difficult. Maybe because I had this exalted idea that, well, yeah, I'm just one of the special ones. I decided I wanted to go back into the creative arts now, because obviously I could be just as much of a success there. So I just go back into the creative arts, and it takes me about 6 months or so to figure out that no one really cares that I'm a writer. Can't get any publishing companies interested in the stuff that I write, because I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know that until much later. So then I decide, well, maybe I'll write the Nitpicker's Guides, because those will have a lot of readers, and one thing leads to another, and one contact leads to another, and ta-da, you know? I find myself an agent. He works really hard. His name was Steve Ettlinger. And actually, David Pogue, who is now the one of the tech writers for the New York Times and has actually hosted some Nova programs. He's done very well for himself, gotten above the ground noise. He was the one who introduced me to Steve Ettlinger. It's really interesting and fascinating connections. It's very, very interesting. So he introduced me to Steve Ettlinger because I have this idea for a book. Takes me a while to convince Steve that it's a good idea because he doesn't watch TV. He keeps calling it Star Wars, and I keep correcting him, no, it's Star Trek. He eventually finds an editor that he hears about at Bantam Doubleday Dell. She says, I want to do these books. That starts the Nitpicker's Guide saga. We write this little book. Dell trade paperback, you know, really doesn't have that much faith that it's going to sell just tons and tons of copies. And they start talking to bookstores, and bookstores start saying, yeah, we think people will be interested in this. And they go back for a second printing before they even start selling the first printing. By the time it's all said and done, they've sold 70,000 copies of that first book in the first year. So, of course, they want to do more. This seems pretty easy to me, you know, because, ta-da, all I do is just decide I'm going to do something, and lo and behold, everything works out. So I do that for 5 years. It all goes well. And then, in May of 1993, which is the year I turned, 1998, May of 1998, which was the year that I turned 40, because I was born in 58, everything blows up. It's just, everything comes apart at that point. Jean Cavellos has since left the company. Her passion and vision for the Nitpicker's Guides are no longer there. There are some lawsuits in the industry. Everything goes away overnight. Okay, well, that's pretty hard. But, you know, up to this point, I've been alive for 40 years, and things have just fallen into place. And I don't, at that point, know how unusual this is. I mean, I just figure, well, it's obvious because I'm just listening really closely to the voice of God. And so I'm just following his path. And if people will just listen to the voice of God and follow his path, all this stuff will work out like this. Now, having said that, it is also, frankly, spectacularly amazing that I have gotten above the ground noise, I call it. I mean, actually been able to make a living and make a good living in two completely unrelated fields. When you look at someone like a David Pogue, he's actually done it the right way. And I haven't had any contact with David in years and years and years. He's actually done it the right way. Because what he did was he started out wanting to do music for Broadway, and so he was working along at that, trying to make that work. And then I guess he had heard about Finale, and he didn't want to pay the price for it, so he thought that maybe he could be a technical writer for Finale, and so that's really how he got involved with helping write the manuals for Finale. Found that he was really good at technical writing, just kept writing technical stuff, kept in that genre, stayed in that slot, ended up at the New York Times doing technical writing. That has since led to the Nova programs, where he's a host and explains technical things. He has stayed in that genre and worked his way up. That's the standard way of doing things. You figure out where you're going to point yourself. You work hard at it year after year after year. And maybe the stars align. And maybe you're able to get above the ground noise and you're actually able to make a good living at it. Because, for instance, in the case of David Pogue, while it's true that I'm sure he has worked very hard and he's made the strategic alliances and he's made the important friendships and all that kind of stuff, the fact of the matter is that if you would look around, you would find there are probably dozens, if not hundreds, of people who were just as talented as David Pogue, but the opportunities didn't quite align. And that's kind of the way it is in the world. So it's kind of extraordinary for anything to line up for anyone to begin with, predictably. It's even more extraordinary for it to happen twice. Now then, even after, okay, this happens, the fact is, I was able to pick myself up after the writing career blew up, go back and learn an employable skill, and I have been able to earn an extremely comfortable living for my family ever since then. Ever since 1998. And it has been, this year, it'll be 15 years. And, you know, there have been times when it looked like the work at my major client is drying up. But there has never been a time that we went without unless it was planned. When the writing career blew up, I did take a multi-month planned furlough because I wanted to learn the current tools. And there was also a musical that was being put on at the church that many years ago I had written the music for, and so there was no way they were going to be able to do the music with it unless I jumped in, because there weren't any music scores for the music. When we had done it at Evangel University years before, I played all the keyboards and I had a flautist that just played some flute parts, and that was it. I mean, and the score was really rough, and so the only way they were going to be able to perform this drama with the music is if I went ahead and played and recorded some music and yada, yada, yada. So I decided I would do that for several months, and then once that was done, an opportunity opened up. And so these opportunities have just gone pow, 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 pow in a row for me. And as I look back on my life, I mean, everything has just fallen into place at the right time. Which is interesting why right now is an interesting time of life for me. Because there is certainly nothing I have to complain about at this point. I mean, my kids are well, my grandkids are well, my wife loves me. I mean, I'm earning a goodly sum of money. We are comfortable. We have heat in our house. Yay! It's supposed to be getting cold tonight. We have heat in our house. And even if the heat goes out in our house, I have wood stacked up in back. I mean, my life is good. Now, are all the doors opening for me like they did in my earlier years where I could do what I wanted to do? As of yet, no. Will they ever again? I have no idea. I don't know. When you just look at it from a human perspective, the answer would probably be no, because I have probably used up all my good fortune having punched above the ground noise not once, but twice. But as I've been thinking about all of this, I've really, I think, come to a peace about it. Because several years ago, I was really trying to come up with a plan where I could get back to writing fast so that I could write full time. And while it's true, I could get more written if I was writing full time, it's also true that even when I was writing full time, I was only putting in about 30 hours a week writing. Because for me at least, I like to have a little decompression time writing. You know, I like to write for a while, and then I like to think about it, and then I write for a little bit more, and then think about it a little bit more. So 6 hours a day, that's pretty good. You know, that's pretty good for me. Well, surprisingly enough, even working quasi full time, there's still enough hours in the day for me to work in the evenings and work on Fridays and work on Saturdays and work on Sundays that I can get pretty close to that 30 hours a week. I mean, I can get up to 20, 22 hours a weekend. So while it is great on the days when I can actually write all day, which I could this last Monday because it was Martin Luther King, and while going back into program after a day like that, or several days, because I had Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, while that's more difficult, I'm getting my mail, one moment. The fact of the matter is, my life is good. I mean, it's good. And the thought that I had this week was, my life is very good. But the early part of my life has been much different than a normal person's life. There are very few people in the world who set their sights on a field of endeavor that they have no training in. I'm backing into my garage. That they have no training in and succeed really well in that field to the place that it could support them, and if they stayed with it, could make them financially independent. And there are certainly even fewer people that after all of that decide that no, they're not going to stay in that field and become financially independent. They're just going to walk away from it and start up in a completely different field of endeavor and yet be able to make a go of it in that field of endeavor as well. And up until that my writing career blew up, I honestly kind of had this attitude of, well, you know, if people would just listen to God and follow God, they could just be successful in whatever they put their hand to do. And successful in terms of the classic definition, be well known, make a lot of money, not just do their job well, which is what I think the Bible is talking about when it talks about Joseph and it says he was successful in whatever he put his hand to do. He did it well. And so I was thinking this week that this time of my life actually is valuable because it does help me understand that there's only so many places up in that top 1% or 0.5% or 0.1% that are known, that are able to do creative things for a living. And there's a whole lot of other people that I can talk to and relate to that are just working jobs and they're looking for meaning. And maybe they find meaning in a creative endeavor that they will never make any money at. And that's okay. Because creative endeavors don't have to make money. I think the job of a creative endeavor, of an epic, of a quest, of an adventure, is really to give your life a little spark. It's really to show you the wonder of there being nothing and then there is something. Because that's what happens in my writing. I sit down and there is nothing. There is a blank page, and when I'm done, there is something. When you make a family, before, it's just the two of you, and there is nothing, and yet out of that wonder of reproduction, you bring forth something, a unique individual. And I think what that does is it gives us this sense of awe of creation and creativity. And it helps us resonate a little bit with what God must feel when he looks at us, when there was nothing and now there's something. And so I think there's a real value in my relating to people and my being in relationships with other people. I think there's a real value to me being in a situation where everything's not constantly just working out for me and may not ever again. And if that's fine, that's the way it is, that's fine. I'm 54. I got the good Ragusa genes, so I will probably be alive, you know, until I'm 90, 95 years old, unless I get hit by a truck or something. So I probably have another 40 years of life or so. And I'll probably wait to retire until I'm 67 or 70, you know, provided I can keep finding work. So what I have ahead of me in these 40 years is that constant uncertainty. Because the future is uncertain. But what I also have is a relationship with God who speaks to me every day, who visits with me, who helps me, who guides me. And now I can actually say to people, you know, God's guidance and God's whispers and God's counsel is not necessarily always going to lead you to the top of the heap. But what it will do is fill you with awe that the creator of the universe wants to be in a relationship with you. And he will guide you through all the various unglamorous pathways of your life. And through all those hills and valleys and mountain experiences, he will, through you, then touch other people. And that's really what it's about. And that's why now I say that the goal of my life is not to have my stuff read by millions or to make millions. The goal of my life is to profoundly affect 12 people. This is Phil Ferrand. And I have made it home.